Welcome back to another Red Star Radio interview. Today I'm joined by Michael Christopher, who is an American communist based out in Laos, and he's written quite extensively on the struggle going on now in Myanmar involving the Burmese Communist Party, amongst other forces, battling the military regime that has ruled intermittently in Myanmar for over 60 years, with a slight break recently for a period of semi-civilian rule. And what we're going to be talking to Michael about today is the history of that struggle. And I want to begin, Michael, just by asking you if you could walk through some of the elements here in terms of the historical aspect. Burma has, of course, or Myanmar, gone by different names. It has been ruled by different kinds of military regimes, some of which refer to themselves as socialists, thinking particularly of the Ne Win regime that ruled from the 60s to the 80s. So if you could start out by exploring some of the historical aspects here, and then we'll take the conversation up to the modern day.
The history of Myanmar is in and of itself a very complicated and in many ways confusing and disputed area. So it's an area that I'm continuing to learn more about and taking a lot of pointers from the Communist Party, because when they won their independence in the 1940s, there was almost immediately a split in the coalition that won their independence. Yeah. So the Communist Party played a very prominent role in that period. And so when the split occurred, the Communist Party was kind of forced onto the front lines of the ensuing fighting. And so they fought for around 40 years. And around the same time the SLORC took over in the following Ne Win is when they officially... The way I've always thought of it is it's like they disappeared. And on my side of things, trying to do research about them, it seemed like there were certain groups that split away, like the United Wa State Party split from the Communist Party, the MNDAA split from the Communist Party. So it seemed like they had kind of disintegrated, and whatever remained of them either took up new groups or I thought most of them had fled to China, to be entirely honest. That was my thought. And so when the most recent coup happened in 2021, the Communist Party issued a statement saying, essentially, we're back and we're ready to fight again, and calling on people to resist the military junta and basically fight for a people's democracy.
Yes.
So when that happened, personally, I was very skeptical. I've been trying to research and understand global politics for a few years now. And so typically when you have someone just kind of show up out of nowhere and they suddenly issue, you know, statements like that, it's suspicious. Yes. And so I voiced skepticism about it. I didn't really believe that they were real at the time. But in 2022, I moved to Laos and I was introduced. It was like a friend of a friend of a friend. And, you know, I mentioned to them, like, I'm in this region, I want to learn more about what's happening. And I am specifically interested in what's going on with the Communist Party. And so through a series of like anonymous interviews and a guy who knows a guy, that kind of thing. I ended up, at first I met with, I think I refer to him as Champo in my articles. Sort of an elder guy who's, you know, he introduced himself as like a businessman. And after speaking with him for a little while, it was like, oh yeah, well, you want to meet the Communist Party? Well, you know, I've been around the block for a few decades. And it turned out that some of them, how can I put this? When asking specific details about what the party was doing in the 1980s, 1990s, they kind of, you know, give a smirk and say, we were doing things. We can't talk about that. It's they said it's a sensitive topic. So essentially, my understanding of what happened was they went underground. Yeah. Because when I first met Comrade Tet, I think is how I refer to him in the articles.
Yes.
He's the commander in the Second Front in northern Myanmar. The first time I met with him and some of his guys, like the first question I had was like, you know, how did you end up in this situation, in this role? Because he's a pretty young guy. He's around the same age as me, and so it seemed like a weird, you know, kind of you know, the paths of life kind of thing. And he explained that he was part of the student demonstrations, the student movement, when the coup first happened. And when they began the crackdowns, they started arresting student leaders and they started firing at unarmed protesters, very similar to what happened back in 1988.
Yes.
When they realized that that's what they were dealing with, a lot of the students started turning to the armed groups. And so he had actually already been introduced to underground communist organizers because they were still active primarily in the countryside with rural organizing.
Right.
And we just didn't know it. There's no one's publishing detailed analyses about rural organizing in the underground radical movement in Myanmar, you know. So they'd been flying under the radar for about 30 years, but when they issued the public call and they said, we're getting the gang back together, his group was one of the first to join up. And I don't remember the exact date. I think it was in April, sometime around April of 2021,
yes.
Was when they started having their first armed battles. Mm. And the way he explained it was that was essentially where he earned his wings.
Yes.
Because he's been in the fight for that long and he's kind of seen how things have gone so far.
So let's just pause there for a moment and just backtrack a little to the brief period of civilian rule in Myanmar, which was brought to an end, as you chronicle in your article, in the coup of a couple of years ago in early 2021, because the way in which this was covered in the bourgeois press in, of course, Britain and elsewhere was that this was a triumph of the Aung San Suu Kyi and her pro-democracy movement. And of course, it should be mentioned that she, if I'm right in saying this, is the daughter of one of the founders of the Burmese Communist Party, Aung San.
Yep.
Is that correct?
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this, she was like, I think her official position was state counselor or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mentioned in one of the statements on the Burmese Communist Party's website that I think you linked to in your article about how there was a surge in foreign direct investment that came, it seemed to come after the restoration of civilian rule. But then there's this coup in 2021. And you mentioned in your articles how this obviously affects the younger generation of who come to be involved in the People's Liberation Army and the Communist Party. So can you talk a little bit about that civilian rule period and also what is it that sort of triggered the military coup in 2021? Is this just a case of the senior clique in the army having essentially private empires that they want to defend at all cost? Is there a faction within the Myanmar ruling class behind them? Can you talk a little bit more about that, please?
Yeah, so it's a lot to dig in there. My understanding of the situation, based on the research that I've been doing and the people that I've been speaking with, the civilian administration under Aung San Suu Kyi was by no means perfect, but it was an objectively better, it was a step in the right direction compared to the military dictatorship periods. So the way things are structured in Myanmar, the top madaw, the military, is a separate entity. So it's essentially beholden to its own self. It's not under civilian oversight. So these government was come in when they were finally able to have elections. There was sort of an asterisk on that, and it was civilian government, but the military is still there, and you can't really tell them what to do. So when the last dictator stepped down, I think his name was Tan Shwe. I'm not great at pronouncing the Burmese names, but I'm working on it. The successor to him, I don't remember the official title, it was like Minister of Defense or something to that effect, was Min Aung Hlaing, who is the now the military dictator. So while the, I guess we could say the pageantry or the beginnings of a liberal bourgeois democracy were being established, in the background, the military maintained its independence, and so it was still continuing on the sort of maintaining its own existence, because they do own private businesses, they do own their own interests that they derive quite a bit of money from, billions of dollars from what I've seen. So even when Aung San Suu Kyi was elected, she had to contend with this independent sort of fascistic pressure from the military. Obviously, from the Western imperialist perspective, it was an opportunity to, quote unquote, open up Myanmar, because it had been very isolationist under Ne Win and the Slork. So, yeah, there was Myanmar possesses vast reserves of natural resources. It is a very rich country in natural resources. And so the ascension of civilian rule, kind of that liberal bourgeois democracy, it's a big win from their perspective. But because the top madaw is still there, when they decided that they wanted to get their piece of the pie again, or they wanted a bigger piece of the pie now that there's more natural resource extraction occurring, there really was no one in a strong enough position to stop them. And that, we could say almost inevitability that would happen, was something that the Communist Party saw coming. And they, I don't remember where they wrote about it, but they issued a rejection of the sort of 2007 constitution that was handed down by the previous military dictator that ended up actually paving the way for the current military dictator.
So you have a situation then, basically, where what has been constructed is a civilian form of government which cannot change fundamentally the underlying structure of the state. It is essentially a not entirely cosmetic, but a face put on this regime in order that it can basically do more business with the imperialist powers, who are more prepared to do that business if they can say to their own populations, look, it's democratized and now we can, I don't know, exploit their natural resources with a smile on our faces. But the military, having had these expectations of particularly younger people raised, sees this power back in 2021. And it is then, of course, that what you chronicle in your article, which is essentially the intensification or the growth of a real people's war, begins. Is it correct to define it in those terms?
I think so, yeah. I don't want to reduce the Suki period as totally ineffective and totally like purposeless. Okay. Because like you mentioned, it did raise the standards and it did raise the consciousness of people's desire for freedom. And this moment, as we speak, the People's Defense Force, which is, I guess we could say they're loyal to the now deposed liberal government. So they're the like the armed wing of that. They're working directly with the Communist Party.
Yes.
So it's I don't want to eschew them at all. It's kind of the inevitable crisis you arrive at with liberalism. And so the hope this time is that they can the idea that I've heard is basically we need to get the job done this time. We need to really put the Tatmadaw under the civilian oversight so that this cannot happen again and build a real multi-party people's democracy.
So essentially the realization has been made is that they cannot leave this structure that's been there arguably since the coup of the early 60s in place anymore, because it simply has it's too easy for them to do what they did in 2021, basically, which is just step in, reestablish a new military regime and carry on as they had done previously.
Precisely.
So the structure then of the forces that are currently opposing the military regime. We mentioned the Communist Party of Burma. You've just mentioned those who are more in line with defending the liberal democratic regime that was overthrown. There's other forces that you mentioned as well. It seems that there's quite a coalition growing there against the military regime that is becoming a serious problem for the military. Would that be correct in saying?
That's a bit of an understatement, I think, at this point.
Well, I am English.
Yeah, the history of Myanmar since the 1940s, there has always been, as far as I am aware, there's always been some group somewhere, someone fighting against the military. It's kind of a constant throughout their history. The Communist Party was doing it for about 40 years. So it's not new that there are armed groups that are claiming to be waging revolution, but it is very new, and it's something that I've been really surprised at the acceleration that's happening, where these groups are coalescing rather than atomizing.
Yes.
So it was a really, really big problem around the Slork period, where you would have a group fracture and, you know, one group would break off and they would form a temporary alliance with the military, and then they would fight against their former comrades, and then they would switch sides, and then they would all fight against the military. And it was this constant, like, shifting sands. That's been the topic of some of my conversations with the comrades on the ground there, is that historically there has been that sort of fair weather attitude about what's going on and how to, it's been very opportunistic. So you've had figures arise who really just wanted to make money. But in this juncture, more and more of these groups are coming together and working together in order to accomplish sort of the uniting key task, sort of the primary contradiction, we could say, and that is end the military junta. Once we end the military junta, then everyone can get their seat at the table and we can deal with our problems however we want to deal with it. So in Operation 1027, I've seen, based on the information they've sent me, there are at least six groups involved with that. The three biggest ones, they're referred to collectively as the Brotherhood Alliance. And so that's the MNDAA, the TNLA, and the AA, the Arakan Army. Those three are all primarily what we call like ethnic militias or ethnic armed forces.
Yes.
So they tend to be more insular, we could say. They tend to be more focused on their own business. Sometimes they fight with each other, sometimes they ignore each other. Now they're working together and they fielded an army of over 10,000 troops. When I spoke with the I had an in-person meeting with them earlier this year, the PLA comrades, and they described to me the speed with which they were growing and developing, and it sounded too good to be true. I try to be objective. I want to be kind of skeptical. So I told them, you know, this sounds too good. You know, what are you guys doing? You know, what are you getting ready for? And the typical kind of style, they smiled and said, you'll see. And so in this engagement, they have sent detachments, as I wrote, from PLA 2 and PLA 9. So they're not fielding anywhere near the number of troops I've been told that they're training and able to call on, but they are fielding troops in support of the Brotherhood Alliance alongside the Bamar PLA, which is another ethnic faction, as well as the PDF, which are the sort of the I'd refer to them a lot as the liberals, but that I don't think that calling them that gives them enough credit for what they're doing. And so, as I wrote in the most recent article, one of the things that stood out to me about this is they mentioned that for the first time, they are now in direct kind of management of a township near the Chinese border. To me, that is a major departure from the tactics that they were discussing when I began interviewing them early this year, sort of at the beginning of this year. Back then, it was more focused on sort of they love Mao, so everything is based on Mao. And there was this idea of being mobile, not being tied down to a specific territory. They would come in, they would hit the enemy. If they could dislodge the junta forces, then set things up with the local people so they could have their little council and then move on, you know, keep moving. So this is very different. This is essentially, it sounds like a shift in some sense. Now, the full gravity of it probably will not be too obvious until the next wave. And when I asked what is the next step, the answer was that the same kind of optimistic, cryptic, you know, a smile and, you know, you'll see.
Yeah. So you mentioned what I think we could call the the elements of the national question in Burma slash Myanmar, which from what I've read and from what you've written about, it seems to be quite a prominent issue there, where the number of ethnic-based rebellions that have gone on against the military regime for a number of decades now. So you mentioned that there's more unity now, but how do the Burmese communists see the future here with regard to the nature of any future state? How do they consider the national question inside Burma?
Yes, so they follow a Marxist-Leninist analysis, and they put a really big premium on Mao Zedong thought. So they take it from that approach, but they also have the insight of having lived the history in Myanmar. Mm. So in Myanmar, there are basically in every state, you have at least one ethnic armed group, one ethnic minority that has set up their own militia. Mm. The history behind those formations, as far as I've been able to find, in every case, it's because of authoritarianism or dictatorship from military juntas. Mm. In other cases where, for example, the occupation of Ireland, it's pretty straightforward. Get out of my land. You know? In Myanmar, everyone seems to be on board with more of a, I want to say like federalized state, sort of allowing a degree of autonomy for the ethnic minority regions, while also maintaining that overarching union, which is Myanmar, that diversity and unity within one kind of big country. I think everyone recognizes that Myanmar is a rich country, and Myanmar has a shared history amongst all of these diverse groups, and so they could have a very prosperous future together. Mm. The question is, how will they get to there? So with the Rohingya people are a pretty good example of how the military has used things like hyper-nationalism. They describe it as fascism, the Communist Party does. Mm. I feel comfortable agreeing with them. In order to foment ethnic strife as an excuse to pursue their economic interests. So there has been an ongoing conflict with the Rohingya people for decades now, off and on. Mm. And kind of a big material driver of that conflict is that the Rohingya people occupy territory on the western coast of Myanmar that would make very nice resorts. Mm. So so they got to go. Fortunately, I think they have been able to fight back to a degree. But unfortunately, it has come at a very steep price.
Well, this is in, am I correct in saying Rakhine State? Is that right? Where the Rohingya people were expelled en masse into India or Bangladesh. Was it 2017? That hit the headlines over here in the usual, simplistic, propagandistic way. But they, from what you're saying, the junta essentially operates in fairly similar manner to old British colonial regimes, in that they will sometimes repress one ethnic group or religious group, perhaps try and promote another, do a deal with another, all to basically keep themselves at the center and to create as much conflict as possible around them to prevent unity arising. Would that be correct in summarizing it that way?
Precisely. Yep.
Yeah.
The likewise, the fact that that happened, there was the big, I guess we could say uptick, or the big escalation in the genocide of the Rohingya people. That happened while Aung San Suu Kyi was still in government. But she was essentially like helpless to stop them because of the way they're structured, because the military does not submit to civilian oversight. So that was one, I think that was around the time when I started getting interested in what was going on, was because it seemed like a huge, huge contradiction that she has this record as a human rights defender and a Nobel Prize winner, I believe, and she's overseeing a government that's committing genocide. You know, what the heck is going on with that? And I think the underlying reality is that, you know, there was really not much she could do. And even if she had spoken out or tried to act more firmly against them, you know, where would she have ended up compared to where she is now, under house arrest?
Well, they probably would have just done the coup 4 years earlier.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely.
So this is a very, very interesting period we're moving into then, where you have a what's clearly a revolutionary situation in Myanmar, with a communist party playing a prominent role in opposing a very reactionary military regime. There was talk by some on the, shall we say, extremely online world that, I think you hinted at this earlier, that some elements in opposition to the military regime were possibly being manipulated by the Americans, who might have their own interests here. But can you address that point? Because I think it's important to underline the fact that even if the American imperialists or the British imperialists have their own agenda, that doesn't dictate the struggles of the people on the ground, does it?
Right. So I believe the first question I asked during the first interview I had with them was, how many Americans do you have running around over there? Like, how many of us are you really like talking to? Like, how deeply involved in this conflict are foreign interests? And you know, I'm a communist, so you know, that's where I sit. But the idea that this conflict, just as any other conflict, would be utilized by foreign interests towards, you know, greater profit extraction, whatever, they're well aware of that possibility, and to a degree that reality. So the answer to the question, are there foreign is there a degree of foreign influence involved here? The answer was, yeah, of course. But it's not the zero sum game that a lot of people who haven't seen a conflict like this kind of imagine it to be. So you don't have, to my knowledge and to the research I've been able to do and the people I've been able to speak with, you don't have a situation like in Ukraine where the PDF is asking the Pentagon if it's okay to attack certain targets. It's not a proxy conflict in that regard. I have seen what I believe to be evidence of Western involvement in a humanitarian front kind of sense. So providing some humanitarian aid to specifically the PDF. I have not seen any evidence of weapons or training or in anything like that. I haven't seen evidence of it. As always, I try to be skeptical. So I ask, I try to see if there's any of that there. Over the past year, I have not seen anything like that. And there, on that note, there are people that say the same thing regarding the communists, that they are a proxy for China. And that is also not the case. They, in the earlier history, they had very, very close relations with China, allegedly. And of course, they have a very, very strong affinity for Mao Zedong thought and the kind of the path of socialism that has happened in China. They've been very open with me that within the party, there is a degree of ideological diversity. So some comrades are kind of that old school style, what we would call like a Maoist. And we have other comrades that view China today as kind of a model. And then there are other comrades that we might describe more as like democratic socialists, where they're compared to us, I guess we could say a little bit more right wing. So one of the negative sides of things of the Communist Party in Burma was that during the Cultural Revolution, they echoed that. And so they had situations where like they executed some of their leaders and referred to them as capitalist roaders. And they've said, yeah, we might have gone a little far. Like that might not have helped us while we were in the middle of fighting a guerrilla war.
Yeah, maybe get state power first.
Yeah, maybe. But so there are some people that say like, oh well, you know, this is a proxy campaign by the Chinese against Western interests, or that this is a proxy campaign by the West against Chinese interests. Not exactly. And the most kind of amazing thing for me to see, it really stood out to me when I realized what was happening, is the Communist Party allegedly has this relationship with China, allegedly that also exists with the Hua state, which is led by a separate organization. So allegedly, they act as proxies for China, while simultaneously, allegedly, the PDF acts as a proxy for the West. Well, they're working together now. Like they work pretty closely together. The PLA supports PDF actions on a regular basis. So what does it say that a U.S. proxy and a Chinese proxy are working together against a military junta? Like it's war makes for strange bedfellows. Like
well, yeah, I mean, from what you're saying, it's also, I think it's worth re-emphasizing that, like, it doesn't seem to me that you could describe any of the forces as straight proxies for external powers. It seems that the perhaps the American imperialists and the British would have an interest in restoring the sort of liberal democratic elements in the system. And also, from what I know of the external relations policy of the People's Republic of China, they're not exactly into backing other parties and armed groups overseas, as if this was like the 60s or earlier with the Soviet Union in the Comintern period. I think that's the right way to put it. Now, but there is a Chinese interest of sorts, isn't there, which is that the northern border of Myanmar, there it crosses into China, is an area which the PRC does have certain problems with in terms of criminal organizations operating there. I think you mentioned this in your one of your pieces of writing, which do create problems within China itself. So there is something of an interest there, isn't there?
Precisely. So I think you described that well. The People's Republic of China maintains a policy of non-interference in foreign domestic affairs. At the same time, it is a known fact, it's been documented, that the gangs operating in the Kokan region, which is where Operation 1027 is occurring, have been working directly with the junta and have made millions of dollars for them. But in the process, they have also trafficked Chinese citizens into the region and forced them under duress to participate in these illicit activities, such as like telecom fraud, which is something that China began cracking down on pretty severely last month, shortly before the operation began. So the people I talked with made it abundantly clear that they are aware of that Chinese interest. They are aware that that is something that China wants done, but there is no, like, they're not being told what to do. They viewed it as not just these are gangs and they're hurting China. These are junta gangs that are helping the junta maintain its grip on power. So if we can liberate some of our occupied territory and deal this blow to the junta, fantastic. If China benefits from it as well, then in the business we call that win-win cooperation.
Yes, as President Xi himself says.
Precisely. So there are moments where the junta government is involved in like ASEAN and Chinese, how could we describe this? Like cooperation mechanisms, such as policing the Mekong River in order to prevent piracy. So there are moments where it looks like the junta gets along pretty well with its neighbors. The reality is not quite such.
Yes, state-to-state relations are always more complicated than they appear on the surface, I think it's fair to say.
Precisely.
So the in terms of the way that the struggle is going to play out, what you've been writing about has even started breaking through into the bourgeois press in Britain now. Wow. It's being picked up by the BBC. So it's even making its way over here. So clearly, the imperialists are paying attention, which means that there's significant events which they are interested in over there happening. So how do you see things proceeding from here, without wanting to, you know, ask you to make too many predictions? So it certainly seems as if the revolutionary process is intensifying at the moment.
I can only share what has been told to me and then speculate wildly.
Well, let's keep this wild speculation for the end of the interview.
In terms of what has been said to me directly, wave by wave, each revolutionary wave will see the struggle move forward a little bit. So right now they're focusing a lot on Kokang. There have been some other smaller operations in other parts of the country, but the emphasis right now, kind of all eyes are on Kokang. For one, it is a shining model of what can be accomplished by a strong, united coalition. And two, they're displaying manpower and material that I don't think anyone realized they had at their disposal at this stage. The deployment of, they claim, 4,000 drones is, that's incredible. I doubt they're using Reaper drones or something like that, but the idea that they have just amassed that much equipment of any kind to any degree, that is pretty massive. So the focus right now is very much on Kokang. They've described that their immediate interest is focusing on securing the border crossings and then moving inland, so to speak.
Hmm.
So as I've said a few times, the PLA is very strongly influenced by the thinking of Mao Zedong. Hmm. And one of the kind of roles that the PLA is playing at this stage is teaching tactics to a lot of different groups.
Yeah.
And so it seems like they agree with them that a rural strategy inspired by the work of Mao Zedong is applicable given the rural conditions in Myanmar. So they've said directly the capital of Kokang, Laokai, will be liberated by the end of this year. They have said that openly. That is their number one goal. By the end of this year, it will be liberated. And so yesterday, actually, the embassy, the Chinese embassy in Myanmar, released an official warning telling all Chinese citizens to evacuate the city if possible, because they are coming. It's going to happen. There have been attempts to retake the city before over the past decade or so by the MNDAA, who originally held it back before 2009. Those attempts have failed, but they have never involved 10,000-20,000 men and a few thousand drones. So it's anyone's guess as to how that might go this time around. So that's pretty big, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And then moving on from there, they have that same kind of mindset of wave by wave, strike at the periphery and isolate the center. And then you can, you know, once you've softened it up, then the center will collapse. That is echoed in the kind of the operational trajectory that this conflict has had over the past couple of years. And it aligns pretty well with the actual conditions in Myanmar, as far as I understand them. The military junta has positioned itself from the capital in the kind of the dead center of the country. And the majority of the population lives in the rural areas kind of arrayed all around it. So they've potentially put themselves in a pretty, pretty bad pickle. But it'll take probably another year or two to see that fully unfold.
Yes, because the it's the purpose-built capital, isn't it, where exactly. The junta rules from, which is a slap bang in the middle of Myanmar. And it's still, as you were saying, an overwhelmingly rural peasant country, despite some industrialization. Mm-hmm. So the principle of essentially taking the countryside, surrounding the cities, and then leaving the cities for later on, shall we say, when you've cut them off, it really does seem to apply to the conditions on the ground in Myanmar.
Yeah, you made the comparison earlier to the junta behaving very similar to colonial Britain.
Yes.
In terms of war fighting, it's been very striking to me how the tactics employed by the anti-junta forces, the coalition, I want to call them, it aligns very closely with the tactics that were employed by Vietnam, Laos, China, and these other, I guess we could say, rural-based communist movements. While the tactics of the junta align almost exactly with the tactics that were used by the French, the Americans, and I'm not too familiar with how the British acted in the region, but probably them as well. So there's a very strong reliance on air power, which has been noted, especially with the bombing of Paziji. There was a village in, I believe it was in Sagaing region, where the junta bombed out this entire village, killed around 300 people because they believed there was some activity happening there. That approach. It's looking at the things happening in the world today, it seems pretty similar to what the Zionists are doing in Palestine as well. This idea of, well, if we just kill enough of them, they'll give up. It's a tale as old as time, and each time it turns out to be wrong.
Yes, and I one detail I wanted to just clarify, the military hunters forces, the army, is that a conscript army?
There has been allegations that they force people to join sometimes. I think that has become more of the case over the past year as areas under their control are kind of falling away from them. And most people aren't very keen on the idea of fighting and potentially dying for the junta. I believe there is a degree of coercion they have to rely on in order to keep the uniforms filled. One report that I saw but wasn't able to confirm was that an entire battalion had surrendered in Kokang, an entire battalion of junta forces. It was told to me by a member of the PLA, but I was not able to confirm if that's accurate or not.
Because if you look back, as I'm sure you have, at the histories of the struggle, the long struggle in China, also Cuba, that reaches a point where like the dictatorship's forces do start to suffer fractures, and you start to see rather large scale defections of men either surrendering or defecting and taking a lot of equipment over with them. So I would imagine if what you're saying and what you're hearing is correct, that we may be starting to see more of that in the near future, given the low level of enthusiasm and support that the junta has, and the fact that they are relying on these colonial type brutish tactics of mass killing to try and sustain themselves.
I think you're right. Yeah. The surrender of junta troops and seizure of their equipment has actually been a tactic that the anti-junta forces have been using for about 2 years now. It was described to me as when they kind of first got things going and they didn't really know what they were doing. The first real method they had for getting weapons was to ambush a group of soldiers and take their stuff. So I've seen plenty of cases where that has happened, where they will capture, maybe capture an outpost and that will surrender, or capture a group of soldiers that they are able to ambush. Sort of, what is that? Subjectively, or what's the word? Not objectively. In my experience, from what I have seen, it would appear that there has been an increasing number of occurrences of that happening, of those types of surrendering and handing over equipment. I agree with you that is probably going to be happening more often as things continue to move forward. At this stage, however, based on what I have seen and what I have been told, they are not in any shape relying on equipment that they're able to intercept from junta forces at this stage. They have procured methods for producing their own uniforms as well as producing their own rifles. I still don't know where they got all those drones from. Maybe they ordered them from Amazon or something, but
they might have been sold them by some Ukrainians. You never know.
I mean, I think all they're lacking at this point would be maybe if the Taliban sell them one of those Apache helicopters the U.S. left behind.
Yes, I was gonna say the struggle in this part of the world, just to conclude the hour on this point, the struggle in this part of the world is very interesting for a number of reasons. It's also like a very strategically important area, given that you have in this area two actually existing socialist states in the form of Laos and Vietnam. And looking into the future, if there's going to be a revolution that cleaned out the junta forces, and even if it were just went to a sort of new democracy period, not an outright socialist state yet, that would be a tremendous step forward, not just for obviously the people of Myanmar, but for the region as well, in terms of future cooperation, more economic integration, more shared projects. Getting rid of this military regime looks to be a potentially enormously progressive act, doesn't it?
Yes. in simplest words, yes. I have not seen any indication that the Communist Party is acting in bad faith, or that they expect, okay, we'll take the junta and then we'll take out everybody else. I haven't seen anything that would imply that. I think they, at this stage, they appear to be earnestly pursuing a parliamentarian sort of multi-party people's democracy. So they want socialism, and that is their end goal. But I have not seen any indication that they believe they'll have to kill, the PDF, for example, once the junta is taken out. I think after that point, I think the entire society would be open and excited for a period of genuine genuine civilian rule, even if it is kind of an imperfect liberal kind of bourgeois democracy. Mm-hmm. I think that would still be a progressive step forward from the kind of fascism they're experiencing now.
Very much so. Well, Michael Christopher, the writer of the article, which we're going to link to from People's World on this, and also there is a Substack piece or two, which you listeners should read. And also I'll link to your X or Twitter profile as well, so people can follow you on there. But it's been a really interesting discussion today. So thank you for joining us, and I hope you can come back again at some point to update us on this struggle. And also in the future, maybe have a conversation about what Laos is like these days. It's a country that doesn't get discussed nearly enough in the West.
Fantastic. Yeah, I would love to. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for the work that you're doing to spread the word. The PLA have said directly that getting the word out there and spreading the information so that people can learn more about what's going on is having a massive positive impact for them. And they thank you. So keep up the good work.
Excellent stuff.